pleasure in the body, the mind becomes very equanimous, very balanced, very much in our right mind, very aware, very accepting of anything that comes into the awareness, not grabbing onto anything because it's self-satisfied, it's cool. And so then, if we're really that self-satisfied, if we're really okay with the way things really are, if we really are equanimous and accepting, the pleasure in the body will fade. It won't just drop away, it just sort of fades away. And that's okay, because we're stable. We're not moving, we're still. We're hollowed out. All the personality, all of I like it, I don't like it, all of the tightness of mind and holding ourselves together for dear life against this crazy world doesn't need to be there anymore. It's just gone. We're just hollow. A beautiful hollowness. And then we arrive at the fourth jhana. Again, monks, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, a monk enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Better translated, and Bhikkhu Bodhi, this is Nyana Moli's translation. Bhikkhu Bodhi changes it later when you read other descriptions that he translates. It's mindfulness purified by equanimity. So equanimity serves a purpose that is purifying. He sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by pure, bright mind. Just as though a man were sitting covered, or a person were sitting covered from the head down with a white cloth, so that there would be no part of the whole body unpervaded or uncovered by the white cloth, so too a monk sits pervading this body with a pure, bright mind, so that there is no part of this whole body unpervaded by pure, bright mind. Covered from head to toe, wrapped from head to toe in a white cloth. What else do we cover from head to toe with a white cloth? A corpse. Psychological death. Here it is. It's perfected, the fourth jhana. I could point to you and you and you and you, all equanimity and mindfulness. No male, no female, no like it, don't like it, no race, no age, nothing. The death of the ego here. The reason why so many of these suttas go from this to insight into liberation is because here we are, where we are a transparent observation, and we can see what really is. We don't mix our personality with what is. Sankara, to make together. Kara karoti, to make. San with, to make together. Sankaras brought to stillness. They're just gone. There's just pure mindfulness, awareness, acceptance. No dog in the game. So then we can look at reality, or I don't like to use the word reality. We can look at phenomena that arise and see their truth on the spiritual path. There's a couple similes given for the state of mind that's able to observe phenomena according to their truth within the spiritual tradition. Just as if there were a lake in a mountain recess, clear, limpid, and undisturbed, so that a man with good sight standing on the bank could see shells, gravel, pebbles, and also shoals of fish swimming about and resting. He might think this lake is clear, limpid, and undisturbed, and there are these shells, gravel, pebbles, and also these shoals of fish swimming about and resting. There's another simile given, the simile of the barrel gem. You know about a barrel cut diamond, this rectangular cut, emerald cut diamond. And if you look at an emerald cut diamond, it has a square or a rectangle in the center. And you look into that square or rectangle and it's just so clear, which allows all of the sparkly facets underneath to come up. And the Buddha says that being in the fourth jhana is like having a mind like this barrel cut gem. And if there were different colored threads strung through it, red and yellow and green and blue, we could see so clearly yellow, green, red, blue. So the simile of the barrel gem, the simile of the lake, these are all just wonderful similes for what the mind is like in this state of the fourth jhana.
You said earlier, I think, that fourth jhana was also covered by the sheet from head to toe. Is that so? There's two similes for the one jhana?
Yeah, so the sheath from head to toe is just symbolizing that the body is so subtle at that point. It's brought to stillness. The body and the gross emotions of the body. When we speak of mind, the third formation, that's all brought to stillness by the immaterial states. But we can, it's said in the suttas, attain to nibbana, see the Four Noble Truths after any of the jhanas. Unlikely after one. Probably unlikely after two. Three, yeah. Four, all the time in the suttas. We're so close to letting go here. It's even said in the commentaries and implied very strongly in the suttas that the immaterial states are based upon the imperturbability, the equanimity of the fourth jhana and are extensions of the fourth jhana. But different. Different purpose, different experiences. They're going outside. The jhanas are about what's going on inside. The immaterial states are about what's going on outside. I don't mean physically outside. I mean contemplation of consciousness, space, like these big questions that are addressed by these states, nothingness, perception. But inside, we're just sensitive creatures with reactions and wants and desires, everything that fills in with color and with form, this outline corresponding to a being. And the jhanas just erase all that. This erasure of our personal perspective, our personal emotions, are what allow us to attain to wisdom, what allow us to see things as they really are. Knowledge and vision of things as they really are happen after this point. And so the sutta continues, with his mind thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, attained to imperturbability, he directs it to the knowledge of the recollection, mindfulness, recollection of past lives. He recollects his manifold past lives. And the Buddha is speaking here in first person. I recollected my many manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, three births, four births, five births, 10 births, 20 births, 30 births, 40 births, 50 births, 100 births. Now it starts going up exponentially. 1,000 births, 100,000 births. Many eons of world contraction, many eons of world expansion, many eons of world contraction and expansion. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my pleasure and pain, such my life term, and passing away from there, I reappeared elsewhere. And there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my life term, and my passing away from there, I reappeared here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. And that was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. In other words, one who abides in meditation. With my mind concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of perfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, fourth jhana, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. With a divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. I understood how beings pass on according to their commas. These worthy beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of the noble ones, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in a state of deprivation, a bad destination and perdition, even in hell in some cases. But these worthy beings who were well-conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers of noble ones, right in their views, giving effect to right view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death have reappeared in a good destination, even in a heavenly state. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing according to their commas. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who abides diligent, ardent, and resolute. What is happening here? These two things, the recollection of one's own past lives or the Buddha's recollection of his past life and the arising and passing on of others, what is this? Causation. That's it. This is the development of the dependent origination. A lot of people pass it over, all this past life stuff. It's just the Vedic Indian kind of overlay or underlay of the Buddha's teaching. No, this is the metaphor for causation. This is the Noble Eightfold Path with right view and right intention. They commit actions and those actions have consequences. There it is. And so in summary of this great view of causation, he thinks to himself, what is the general principle that underlies causation? What is the general principle that he abstracts from seeing manifold examples of beings arising and passing away, of doing actions and then suffering the consequences of those actions, of intending and then receiving a result? What is it? It's the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering. This is the origin of suffering. This is the cessation of suffering. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the third true knowledge that arises, the abstraction from the first two of the general principle which underlies all of existence, the Four Noble Truths, cause and effect, right? This is what happens when you have a clear mind, cleared out of all your personal inclinations, emotions, even your body and the impingement of your body. You can see that there's this beautiful principle underlying everything. It's all cause and effect. And if there's suffering, it has a cause. And when you remove that cause, suffering ends. And when that happens, of course, the taints, the underlying flows, the underlying gates of unwholesomeness that are within us, craving for being or being itself as a taint, sensual desire, craving for annihilation or non-being and ignorance. Sometimes later on views are added, the taint of views, diti, that's later. But these taints are destroyed and again, you can't look back. You can't unhear English after you've... That's, if it's your mother tongue, it's your mother tongue. You can't just hear the sound anymore. It's part of you. That's what the dhanas are meant to accomplish. They are meant to put you in a state where something new can become a part of you, can change you deeply. Not as a matter of belief and repetition. It's a matter of your direct experience. There's a wonderful simile given for the four jhanas in the Athasalani, which is a commentary that Buddhaghosa composed on the Abhidhamma. And he compares the four jhanas to this. Suppose there were a person wandering in the desert, thirsty, just, you know, our normal picture. We've all seen the Warner Brothers cartoons, right, of being in the desert and really on the edge of ruin. And such a person sees in the distance a oasis, not a mirage, but an oasis. And their heart leaps up. I'm saved. I was on the edge. And aren't we, when we're dealing with the hindrances and trying to unify our mind or have some sort of meditation come together, aren't we in the desert? In the desert of wandering and doubt and craving and just being unfulfilled. And here is the thing, the great thing, the great salvation. And the heart leaps up at that. Rapture. That's the first jhana. Seeing the oasis, seeing the water, seeing your salvation, seeing this vision of meditation coming together, spreading out before you, and you feel enraptured. It's elevating. There's movement. It just surges through you. It doesn't have to be like that all the time. But that's what the simile for first jhana is. And then you get to the oasis and you stand on the edge of the pool, clear pool, refreshing pool, clear water, and you jump in and you drink your fill. And that is the second jhana, refreshment. Piti Sukha, born of immersion, which is what Sujato likes to translate samadhi as immersion, right? So we're immersed in this lake, we're cooled off, we're drinking the water. You drink your fill, filled with the joy of the spirit. My soul was thirsty, how thirsty my soul was, how lost. And then you come out of the water and your clothes are sort of there and you lay your bathing towel out to dry and you sit under a palm tree under its nice big fronds and you think to yourself, I've never been so happy and contented in my life. That's the third jhana. So happy and so contented, and you lean your head against the palm tree and you just so sweetly, so gently, so effortlessly just fall asleep. The body, motions, asleep, tranquilized. Fourth jhana. It's a beautiful simile. Illustrates the process so well. Getting rid of ourselves is actually very pleasant. It's what we want to do. But this too is impermanent. Only seeing that underlying principle makes it permanent. But seeing that underlying principle rises up out of this experience. For anybody who's a spiritual seeker, it does. Okay, you know, maybe non-spiritual seekers or, you know, the man will get a hold of this and turn it into a pill or something. Okay, they're not going to get the insight. You have to have the spiritual quest within you. You have to have the spiritual longing. You have to have dukkha touch you, which sets up the frame of the question. And this answers it on a level that is absolutely transformative.
Is there a relationship between understanding Nama Rupa and these jhanas, in the sense that Nama Rupa, you know, body made of mind, is there some kind of correlation?
Body mind or body, did you say body made of mind? Right, so body, mind, it's too far to say body made of mind, I think, although his body is made from mind. Mind precedes all things. Is there something? Yes, it tranquilizes Nama-rupa. Yes, yes. And maybe we need a further tranquilization of the immaterial states. Maybe, well, that's tomorrow. I'll talk about why we practice those and the spiritual itches those are scratching. Yes.
And not from my...
Not from your body. Okay. But it's not a thought, because that's coarse, that's gotten rid of by second jhana, right? But there's this... The experience for many people in the fourth jhana is the moonlight, just pervasive moonlight radiance. All beings, sabbe satta.
So, question. Sometimes you feel it at the top of your head. Are you supposed to... Put your attention at the top of your head, or are you just like kind of diffuse attention, but aware of that feeling?
The attention will be very naturally sharp, and the radiance will appear to you.
Mm-hmm.
And just sit there and hang out with the radiance. Just admire the beloved. Admire the radiance.
So don't focus too much.
Don't focus at all.
Yeah.
Just behold the spirit.
So earlier you said that the purpose of the jhanas is to like set the stage for this permanent insight to arise. And I'm curious because, like, at least from like some Vipassana traditions, like the Malai, the jhanas, or at least like the Samatha flavor of the jhanas, a very indulgent state. So I'm curious, is that like just a misunderstanding of the jhanas, or is that like certain traditions, particularly Twin, are honing in on that insight in a way that might not happen with another approach to the jhanas?
So we have to be understanding and respectful of all practitioners, including our brothers and sisters who practice the Vipassana method, a great method for some people. Buddhaghosa interpreted a rather dubious line, maybe even two words. I put a footnote somewhere and something I wrote to it in the suttas to come up with this idea that there are 10 corruptions of insight. And four of them are the seven factors of awakening. You know, it is inevitable in every culture that it goes through this cycle of Puritan fear of pleasure. It's just from a puritanical mistrust of pleasure, wisely so when it comes to sensual desire, but we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And so in Vipassana, there is just this sensitivity to that part of the early writings from Buddhaghosa, from the Visuddhimagga, that these pleasures are a diversion from the path. But as I said, well, as the Buddha said, I don't have to say anything. As the Buddha said, these should be pursued. They are not to be feared. They should be cultivated. They are wholesome. They are the bliss of Nibbana, the bliss of peace. And as we said earlier, too, they don't leave like this hangover. If they did, then everybody would be rushing to the cushion instead of rushing to lunch. And I dare say we rush to lunch a little bit faster than rushing to the cushion.
So when I do feel like I have a hangover, mm-hmm. is that just because I'm still within a certain like jhana mindset, like experiencing like just a deep, like overwhelming calm if I just close my eyes again after the sit? Like for me, that feels like a really intense hangover.
Oh, the calm. I'm sorry. Maybe not addiction. I meant.
Oh.
Addiction, the jhanas leave a wake, they leave a glow after them. And if you got some decisions to make about your life, make them then, please.
So the other angle I've heard on the jhanas is like, it's like the hard versus soft debate. People saying like, oh, like soft jhana, it's like not the real deal. Is there like anything to be said of that? Like thing of like...
Well, there's lots to be said about that.
Anything that you're like, are you fundamentally getting a different type of thing in the hard jhana, or is it just a difference of degree?
There are sutta jhanas versus jhanas as they're presented later in the Visuddhimagga. And so those, I think, maybe are your, quote, hard jhanas. It's just the jhanic factors are so much stronger that you don't really have anything coming up other than them in the meditation. And so you don't have this opportunity to practice the insight in the meditation. That's why they're hard. They exclude everything else. I don't think they lead somewhere else. But you have to engage in the insight practice more deliberately when you come out. And the wake of those jhanas is probably comparable to the jhanas we're practicing, you see. So in the wake of those jhanas, the afterglow that those leave, the after effect that those leave in the mind is so just blown out and pure from that, that when phenomena do arise, I mean, it's just like you feel the feet of a mosquito like a ton of bricks. And then you can see causation and the three characteristics very easily after coming out of those jhanas. Just happens afterwards, just when the insight is happening. The big myth is that, you know, you have to drag your mind to insight after the jhanas. It's like, no, if your eyes are open and you're experiencing after the jhanas, the insight's just there. It's just there. Everything's in slow motion. Everything is, you can't avoid it. You can't avoid it unless you're like a 12-year-old that's, you know, huffing the jhanas. Isn't this cool? Right? But that's not spiritual seekers. That's not spiritual seekers. Spiritual seekers are after truth. They're after an experience that will teach them, that will free them. And so those are the people that have the 12-year-old cannot get into those kinds of jhanas, or I dare say any kind of jhana with a sort of, let's see if this is cool kind of mind, because there's lots you have to do in preparation to get into those things that also involve a lot of provisional learning and acceptance of a view and restraint. So I think all of those things make this idea that these Visuddhimagga jhanas are dangerous just a red herring. And insight just arises after them. Fine. Some people require that. I'm going to get to you, Alex. Some people require that level of jhana. Some people have so much going on inside, they need their bell rung hard. Okay, I give them that. I make room for them, let 1,000 flowers bloom. I make room for people having different minds, different kinds of experiences, and just needing the deep peace that those jhanas, or those intensity of those jhanic factors bring. The jhanic factors also arise in vipassana. It's very clear if you read The Progress of Insight by Mahasi Sayadaw, they arise. Rapture arises, piti arises, sukha arises, equanimity arises, and then you're promptly warned, don't get attached, and they're not the object. But they arise because in the process of secluding the mind and of learning and of having insights, it produces these calm experiences. And then the calm experiences produce the deeper insights. It's a cycle.
So I remember, actually, Vante, I think he's meant to be in meditation, so about that question, you said that you were practicing Baal before you joined this, and that you found that this jhana, essentially you rejected that one, that practice of jhana in favor of this one. But I can't remember the details of why you chose this practice over that one. And particularly that these states over those kind of deep absorption states.
Yeah. Well, how many days left? Yeah, this is a big topic. I don't think I can answer that properly in 5 minutes. But, and I also really cherish harmony within the Sangha and within spiritual traditions. And the Pa'ok, quote unquote, hard jhanas, or whoever, you know, Ajahn Brahm, I practice Ajahn Brahm's way also, I practice Bhante-ji's, Bhante-gunaratana, his way of approach, which had metta, actually, as like a one-pointed focus metta to enter absorption jhanas, basically. And he actually took that from Bhante-ji Ramsey. He was inspired by Bhante-ji, spent some time in Virginia with Bhante-ji when he first arrived there. And then Dibbutt had a few times, I heard. But yeah, there's an actually really old video of them teaching together, and they're like both young, really young. So it's really like it's kind of a funny. And there you can see there's a little bit of, both are kind of very different in their approach and very, very firm in their differences. And so it's always a little bit of a friction topic, I think, but I also practice, you know, Native American traditional healing practices, like sweat lodge ceremonies, and no, there was no peyote or like, all clean, like natural things in there. And actually, for me, sweat lodges, for example, I came out of some 3 or 4 hour sessions in there, and my mind was clear, like I did a 10-day Vipassana retreat. And I was just really amazed. And that was actually my first introduction to the relax step. Because in my own Vipassana practice, there was no relaxed step. And I'm talking in a very neutral way. This is my own experience, and you do whatever you want with that. But I was never feeling like I was actually letting go and doing Vipassana. And doing the sweat lodges, what was happening to me was like I had to let go of everything. Because you're in there, and you can't, it's so hot. You can't even think. Like if you think, like it's just like it's like you're in hell, basically. You're just like you can't even hold on to a thought. You have to let it go. And when you do that for 3-4 hours at that intensity, your mind just like is zapped. It's completely out, and it's bright and it's pure. And I was really amazed by these practices. That was actually part of my journey, and very very high on my journey actually. And I did that in many places, in Quebec, well, Eastern Canada and Mexico and all that. But throughout all these practices, what I came to was that it wasn't for me, it wasn't punching out. It wasn't actually punching out of samsara. There wasn't nibbana. It was always, the limit was always clear awareness. And there was always, obviously monks cannot talk about their meditative attainments. It's part of our vinaya. So I cannot talk about a jhana or a meditative state or an attainment and relate it to myself. So I have to be mindful of that. But For me, the hard jhanas, I think what I come back to a lot of the time is that there's, the Buddha said that there's four ways to attain enlightenment. And there's the short and painful way, the painful way with long, painful way. There's the painful way with quick result, and then there's the pleasant, long pleasant path, and then there's the quick pleasant path with quick results. And so when we talk about these practices, I feel like in the end it all boils down to how long you want to be in pain for. And how long I think that these practices can lead to some degrees to awakening, a lot of those, depending on, you know, the insight, the wisdom that you develop around them. And like, for example, a really well-known example of this is Ajahn Mun. I don't know if you've heard him. He's very famous Thai Ajahn, who's, yeah. Okay, good. Anyway, so anybody else interested? Okay. And I, you know, Ajahn Mun has such a huge reputation about him, and he was a really hardcore, one-pointed master. He was like the leader, you know, of one-pointed concentration practices. The leader of the Thai forest tradition. He was meditating in the jungle with tigers and, you know, whatnot, and with nothing, practicing all the duttangas. He was really intense. And you have like Longpor Mahabua, who was part of his lineage. You know, like Ajahn Mun, like when he passed, like his relics turned into like crystals, you know, and it's like all these amazing things. I don't know his mind. I don't know what he attained. And of course, I'm sure very few people could know that, but or verify that. But it seems like it would be possible that this could be attained in some ways. But this path looked, for me, when I look at this path from the outside, it looks very painful. It looks like, you know, these monks were going in the jungle and they were sleeping with tigers. They never knew every night if they were going to die eaten by like tigers and all these things. And so it made their practice really edgy and really, you know, pushed them like to the very edge every day, keeping them on their toes. And the kind of insight that you get from that is quite deep and quite profound as well. How does it work? You know, I think I also believe, because it was part of my journey to kind of, I was looking for answers who could explain to me the sutta jhanas, basically. And because in my own practice, I was reading the suttas and I didn't understand. Like, I didn't understand. Like, that was not my experience of the thing, even with the absorption jhanas and even with all of that. So it seemed to me that there was definitely different, like, really different interpretations of these things. I guess maybe it would be wise to leave it there. So for me, I cannot say that, you know, having practiced these practices, and it was such a huge part of, you know, my journey to discover this way, I cannot say that it was just a complete change to my understanding and reading the suttas and being able to actually relate, to be like, yeah, this is what I experience now, like word for word almost. Whereas before, I didn't really feel at all. It was really elaborate mental games with Abhidhamma and talking to really high, like abbots of monasteries in Asia and all that, very highly well-respected monks, telling me that I'm just a lay person, I can't understand that, you know, it takes at least 2 years for a monk to attain first jhana. So it's just a very, very, very different path. And even when we say that, and that's Pahog, there's other interpretations, you know, there's Ajahn Sona, there's mm-hmm. Ajahn Brahm, there's Bhante-ji,
mm-hmm.
they're not the only ones, there are absorption jhana proponents out there. Their teachings are not the same. So it's, like, I mean, in a very kind of noticeable way, because I've practiced in their ways also, so there are similarities, but it's there are quite noticeable variations also. So it's kind of keeping an open mind towards that, and finding your own way. Personally, once David Johnson told me that was a Dhamma Sutta, because I said I was going to go to Pahog to ordain before I encountered Tung, and he's like, do you think you could go back to one-pointed breath awareness? I was like, there's no way. There's no way. Because when you're practicing this way, that, and I have a lot of students that have done that, and actually we consider that as a hindrance, because the mind is actually latching on. It's not progressing and it's not letting go. So every time a student does that, it's actually explaining how, well, do you see the tension? Can you release and relax that? And but they can, I'm sure, lead to certain degrees of understanding, depending on the path and the pleasure on the or the unpleasant path you want to take.
Just that particular sutta on the different ways, my understanding is the Buddha is speaking and he's talking about the karmas of the people who undertake the spiritual path. So it may not be a choice for a lot of people, right? It just might be the natural evolution of your spiritual path. Some people are of a nature to have painful practice with quick results, painful practice with slow results, pleasant practice with slow results, pleasant practice with quick results. May you all be of the fourth variety. There are some people who have a knack for different things. Some people on the Vipassana path, they just have this natural balance of equanimity going into it, and they just take off. So who are we to say? And in the suttas, we have jhanas followed by insight. We have insight in the jhanas. One of my favorite ones, I think it's the shorter discourse to Melunkyaputta, where you analyze each of the aggregates within the jhanas. So there's insight in the jhana, there's insight after the jhana.
As you know, I'm kind of the same sentiment of you, that you know, I can't say much about other people's past and whether they're valid or not, you know, but it does seem like there is a variety, and people can definitely experience, you know, similar things over time based on their constitution, and who's to say. Not to be devil's advocate, just to it should be short enough. Basically, to get to my point is, it does seem different, not just different, you know, not just different jhanas. It seems like, you know, this idea of having access, concentration, taking out an aspect of your experience and getting absorbed in that seems. It is very different from, you know, what I feel like we're practicing, which is like suffering arises and you're using that to access the jhanas. I mean, that's kind of a way of putting it, but you know we have the hindrances come up, we let go of them, we relax, we dissipate that craving, we enter jhana. Then the next jhana, I'm not necessarily picking out an aspect of that jhana and absorbing into that. I'm actually using the hindrances that arise to move deeper into the next jhana. Because when the disturbances come up, I'm opening up and relaxing. And, you know, without them, yeah, it's just cool, I'm in this great jhana, you know. But it is actually the suffering. And I feel like we're moving through the jhanas with the Four Noble Truths, using the Eightfold Path every time they come up, mm-hmm. going deeper. And that does feel, to my mind, substantially different, these other jhanas. Not that, you know, you can't do them and then access the Four Noble Truths and that knowledge in the other way, but it just feels like there is something really substantial about this practice and this method of jhana that is really just deep and effective. And, you know, immediately affects, we all like to say.
No one could, I hope no one would argue with that. Well, how could you? That's a true statement about this method for many people. And I think that's wonderful. Yeah, but there's always the urge to say it must be, this is the way. Nope, I will never do it. Different constitutions require different things. Yeah. I think we need to be open. Even outside of Buddhism,
I'm finding it difficult to discern the boundary of chanda and desire, particularly for this practice and craving. When I'm up against what I would call, for me, a common experience, when I attain the sphere of perpetual not yet. and I try to back off the craving. It seems like I just sort of slip away. So it feels like I'm trying to sort of find the magic hole in the wall that's covered over with plaster. And I keep hitting that wall, and hard to know how to go forward.
You're missing something. When you let go, when you relax, you have to feel the bliss of the relaxation. You have to feel the relief that that brings. You skipped right over it. That's what lets you know where you need to be. Because that relief, that bliss of letting go, puts your mind in the right state to continue with the meditation. If you just let go and slip back without making that vital step of seeing this opening of bliss within you, even ever so slightly, then you're going to lose interest. There's nothing interesting about relaxing and just like going back to watching. That's not interesting. It's boring. But bliss is interesting. So make sure you see that.
So the other way to ask that question is, it's often difficult for me to differentiate between letting go and giving up. So
giving up is a negativity, and sloth and torpor will come.
Yeah,
but sloth and torpor, when you give up, it's sort of a sloth and torpor, and there's a little bit you'll notice of just like a criticism of self, a little bit of ill will when you give up. Like, there's a little bit of that. But when you relax, that's different from giving up. Relax is opening. Giving up is pushing away.
Jordan suggested another R as relief. Yeah. Obviously, you know, a lot of hair stand on that.
The right effort to make a wholesome thought arise, which has not yet arisen, is actually happening in three places in the six R's. When you feel the relief of the relaxation, you re-smile, you return to the wholesome object. That's an emphasis of the third step of right effort three times.
I'm struck by the spectrum and diversity of views on the jhanas, and it's helpful to sort of have them mapped as like sutta, sutamanga at one point and versus six R perhaps. Yes, yeah, Leith does a great job pointing that out. The other thing that I found myself wondering when I look at that map is like how it came to be. And the closest story that I've heard is the jhanas went through a period of more or less like mythologized, like became almost like myth or legendary. Like it moved over time to a place where one pointed over Sudamaga jhanas were dominant. This sort of like twin interpretation, the six R's were lost in a sense. And then Mahasi Sayadaw and Dry Insight arose in response to be like, no, you don't need to do the 2 years as a monk in order to hit jhana in order to proceed in awakening. In fact, there is this other way, the Dry Insight way, that is available to everybody. And this was sort of like a happy relief for those who felt like this was unattainable. And then the sutta-based interpretation arose once again in response to both of the above. I'm curious to know if that is, and at all, how you all understand the development of the spectrum, or of the spectrum, or if you'd add or add to that.
It sounds like you have a book to write.
Oh, definitely, I got 4 seconds. I don't
think I
call it a book.
Yeah. A lot of it's just going to be personal opinion and speculation. It would require knowing a lot of history of the period after the Buddha's death, the transmission to Sri Lanka, what was happening in Sri Lanka before Buddhaghosa wrote down the commentaries, what was happening at the time of the writing down of the three baskets, what the practice was like of the monks between the death of the Buddha and the time of Buddhaghosa. Lots of things and hazy histories, but you can, yeah. We do know for sure that there was a deliberate decision made in response to famine in Sri Lanka, that the priority should be given to preserving the word, the Buddha Vachana. So Theravada and Buddhism kind of went in an academic direction. Whether that means that the practice direction was lost, well, you know, being a scholar and a practitioner is really hard at the same time, and you kind of need to do both. You need to be a scholar to practice well, and you definitely need to practice to understand the words in the canon. So, Bhante, do you have any takes on that?
not like the full truth, and I would agree with Rachel, but I can't remember if I said this already, but I was just at the cave in Aluya in Sri Lanka where they put down the canon on paper for the first time, and the monks at that time, it was roughly 300 years after the Buddha's passing, there was a 12-year famine, and they thought, well, we have to write that down so that we don't lose it, because they were just like eating leaves off the trees and trying to survive. I don't think that the Buddha's teaching was kept intact at all this whole time. I think we barely lost it many times, in fact, when it was wiped away from northern India with the invasion quite quickly, and then it had this kind of, like, a lot of monks fled because of it was just a slaughter, basically. Nalanda was destroyed. And then you have these things happening in Sri Lanka. There's just been, it's not just one thing that has happened, that the Visuddhimagga has had its influence, but it's not the only thing. There's been, you know, there's more than one country at play here, more than one beliefs, and every people, I think, is kind of proposing different, slightly different approaches also. To me, I personally, I don't like to use the word twin in the first place. I don't like that we're starting a new thing. I don't think that's the way it should be. I really am.
High five.
Yeah. Like, I never was in that, like, and I kind of, yeah, there was some criticism about that too, but anyways. So, you know, I don't think twin is a thing. I just think, for me, it was always to go back to the suttas, the Anapanasati Sutta, for example, because I practiced the Anapanasati, like, one-point breath for a long time. I was interested in knowing more about it, and then I went to the suttas and learned a little bit. And I was like, where do I find the word nostril tips? It's not in there. It's just not in there. Like, it's, and that's one of the talks that really struck me as I listened to Bhante Ramsey explaining it was either the Satipatthana Sutta, which has the same sequence at the beginning, and he says, so did I say the word nostril tip? Did I say the word abdomen? And he says, why? Because it's not in there. And it's true. And when you know these things, I was reading the suttas and it didn't make sense. And so for me, it's not about criticizing other ways of practices, it's about going back to the original words of the Buddha. And I think that's really what matters. And when you go to the suttas, and if whatever anybody else says about these practices, if it doesn't match, and that's the Buddha himself said that in the suttas, if it doesn't match with the suttas, that's not what I said, that's not my instructions. And if it does match with the suttas, if it does match with the discourses, with what I said before, then you can think that I probably said it. It's probably the right way, or the right way. Mm-hmm. what I said. I mean, for me, I cannot drop that part where, you know, I really definitely looked a lot in a long time for this. So I can't just say, like, oh yeah, just do whatever, you know. Like, it's just, that's impossible for me to say that. Because it's such a blessing to have encountered this. And it's not for twin. It's Bhante, the way that I explain it usually is that Bhante gave me the knowledge that I needed to understand the Buddha. And from there everything unlocked for me. Not really like twin was a conduit, yes, but it's a lot more than that. So that's, yeah.
Buddha is
yeah.
Our teacher.
Yeah.
And then,
mm-hmm.
Our own experience.
Yes, exactly.
Teacher.
Mm-hmm. That's what I think. So.
Good question. Yesterday you mentioned, Bhante, that in order to have awareness, you have to have an object to be aware. So I'm wondering, in the eighth jhana, or when you have the non-perception, non-perception or non-perception, what is your awareness, or what is your meditation object? Is it just of nothing? Wouldn't that be an awareness of nothing?
Yeah, exactly. I call that stage of bare awareness. That's how I call it. And that's how it translated, bare awareness, because it's just awareness aware of itself. And at that point, and see, it's still an object. It's not that you're taking it, but that's what the mind is aware of at that point. Because if there was no awareness of an object or something, then there wouldn't be awareness. That's called Nibbana or Nirodha. So, yeah. But the object becomes more and more subtle as we release.
Yes.
Last question. I know we had the debate about the word radiate, and what I had tried to do before, I guess my misunderstanding was that if I would just be in that state, then I would be emanating whatever, that to me radiate. But my question would be that, so I gave it a try, well, I'm actually radiating, and I felt like I was overpowering the background of, you know, the jhanas. So I guess that finding that medium where you're not overpowering and you felt like, am I making an effort? Is it just so powerful that it just take over the background of infinite space and infinite consciousness and nothingness? Because before I would be seeing a lot of that in periphery, and maybe the emanating was smaller in portion because I radiated with the resonance and frequency of that. But then now I'm saying, okay, let's radiate. And then so I'm powering that. Is that wrong, that I'm doing like too extreme on both sides?
Yeah, it should be really natural. And the mind, it's like when you start with the metta, that's kind of like giving that first momentum. And then the mind just enjoys releasing more and more, and the bliss that comes through calming down. And the radiation will naturally calm down. If you try to make it in a way, then you're kind of getting in the way, and that's going to create problems. But if allowing it as much as one can to radiate and to the radiation to calm down, when you're radiating equanimity, it's very, very, very subtle. It's not strong at all. So it's just this one step away from the clear mind. Because at some point, the mind will get kind of fed up with radiating. Will be seen as troublesome, basically. It's like, it's a little bit heavy. And so the mind will just want to rest there. And so this is very, very, very subtle. So it's more a let go process than an actual, you say the word radiating in the Arupa Jhanas, but once one is in the Arupa Jhanas, it's very subtle.